I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. It's been a month, but Nish and I are back together again on the pod. Hallelujah! This week, we are talking about the sexual harassment allegations against Willow Creek Church founder Bill Hybels and the announcement that he is resigning immediately.
We'll also discuss a BuzzFeed analysis of Muslim bashing by Republican politicians, and we'll dive into Amy's recent excellent piece for the New York Times on evangelicals and Trump. Before we begin, a quick reminder that if you like what we're doing with this show, you can support Impolite Company by becoming a sponsor. You just click the link in your player's episode description, or you can visit patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. We are halfway to our goal, and we are so grateful to those of you who have already become patrons for as little as $1 a month.
In addition to being back for the show, Nish has returned to Twitter after an absence of several months. And Nish, I want you to know how hard it was for me not to respond with, "New phone, who dis?"
I appreciate that.
That should mean we have no more need for the 3 minutes of Nish segment. But it has been such a listener favorite that we have decided to keep it for now. Now I just need my own segment. So if any of you have suggestions or requests for what that might be, please send them our way. And Nish, your time starts now.
On Wednesday morning, it was announced that Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, the most powerful invertebrate in Washington, would not be seeking re-election in 2018. First of all, Paul, don't let the door hit you on your way out. Also, really great job ballooning the deficit by well over $1 trillion by giving tax cuts to the uber rich while screwing the poor, then deciding to cut and run like an asshole. Really great job. Well done. Nailed it. But you know what? That's par for the course for this guy. The man that so many conservatives have defended time and time again, talking about how he's a good man and a man of integrity, a man of real principle, you know? But you know what? For a long time, I believed them. I gave Paul Ryan the benefit of the doubt because too many sincere, good people kept telling me that he was a really smart guy who cared about policy and principled politics and character and integrity. But then 2016 happened. And I thought that the principled smart guys like Paul Ryan would do more to stand up to a racist, embarrassing autocrat who brags about sexual assault and abuses his country with a perpetual list of horrors, like threatening nuclear war on Twitter. I thought Paul Ryan had principle, you know? But you know what? They're not principles when you abandon them at the first sight of political expediency. And it's not integrity when you perpetually lie to the American people. And it's not good character when you refuse to stand for what's right because it might cost you some tax cuts. And you know, I guess this rant is actually directed toward me as much as it's directed toward him. Every time I watched him swat away questions about Trump's latest authoritarian move, I would ask myself, how could he not care about this? How could he not care about our country? But the truth is, you guys, he never actually cared. Too many of us, myself included, were gullible enough to buy his principled policy wonk character that he put on TV and actually tried to take it seriously. His integrity and principled character was a complete fabrication. It was all a lie. And too many of us bought it hook, line, and sinker. And what he's left us with is a $1 trillion deficit that has paved the way for slashes to entitlements, no compromise on dreamers, and an increasingly fascist president who remains unchecked despite his perpetual racism, corruption, bigotry, and hatred for the rule of law. The Nigerian author Chinua Achebe once said, "One of the truest tests of integrity is its blunt refusal to be compromised." Well, Paul Ryan failed that test miserably, and he failed our country when it mattered most. And that's what I have to say about Paul Ryan retiring.
Let's get straight to our first topic, the abrupt resignation this week of Bill Hybels, the founding pastor of Willow Creek Church outside Chicago. Hybels, who is sometimes credited with being the original megachurch pastor, has been in the news for the past month because of accusations of sexual misconduct against him from multiple former employees. Hybels has called these accusations, quote, flat-out lies, unquote. But on Tuesday of this week, one of the women outed herself and wrote in detail about her experience with Hybels on her personal blog. That evening, Hybels and his family appeared at Willow Creek to announce his immediate retirement. He did not admit guilt or offer an apology, but instead said that he wanted the situation to stop being a, quote, distraction for the church. Listeners, this is a complicated story for us. When it came to promoting women's voices and placing women in positions of authority and leadership, particularly as teaching pastors and as pastors who were planting churches, Bill Hybels was one of the good guys. In our very first episode of Impolite Company, in fact, we discussed his planned retirement and the fact that he had selected Willow Creek's current executive pastor, Heather Larson, to succeed him as the church's lead pastor. But obviously, men who support women professionally are not immune to abusing their power or making poor choices when it comes to their personal conduct.
And this is also deeply personal for me. I know the Hybels family. Shauna is Bill Hybels' daughter, Bill and Lynn Hybels' daughter, and she is a dear friend of mine. She wrote the foreword to my book. I have traveled overseas with her and her mom, Lynn. Lynn, in a lot of ways, I've seen as kind of a mentor in my life. And so I have a pretty significant personal connection to the Hybels family, and so which obviously makes it a lot more complicated. So I just wanted to go ahead and like lay those cards on the table and say, you know, this is not just complicated for the sake of women in ministry, but complicated, I think, for a lot of people, especially kind of in our circles, Amy, who know Bill, who know Lynn, or who know Shauna. It's just incredibly, I think it's incredibly painful no matter which way you spin it. No matter what angle you choose to look at it, it's obviously incredibly painful for the people who are victims. It's incredibly painful for the Hybels family. It's incredibly painful for the people who love them and who have gone to their churches or who have gone to churches that have been planted by Willow Creek, which I have been to one of those as well. So, I mean, these sorts of allegations, no matter when they come up or in what arena they come up in, it is always a mess, but man, does it get messy when it hits the church, you know? And this is one of those instances where it's just incredibly painful. And it's hard to not look at it from the perspective of like the women in ministry argument, like what we kind of mentioned earlier. Bill has always been a big proponent of women in leadership. Willow has always led on that issue. And so it's hard for those of us who try to lead well on the issue of women in ministry to look at this situation and go, oh gosh, is this going to set us back? Or is this going to do damage to that cause?
Right. We should mention that the timeline there was that I believe last fall, Bill had announced that he was going to retire effective October 2018. And there has been a succession plan in the works for quite a while. He knew that he wanted the church to continue after he retired, and that part of his legacy was going to be having a smooth transition, which, oops, at this point. But as you say, like that, this just kind of speeds that up by, what, 6-7 months. But, you know, there's going to be a follow-up because it is already being, it's quite ugly. One of the additional complicating factors is that some of the folks who were involved very early on with Willow Creek, either as founding elders or as other pastors who were involved decades ago, are some of the individuals who have wanted to bring this to light because they have been concerned about transparency in leadership, just among pastors in general, but especially with Bill Hybels. And I know there are folks who are debating the timing of all of this, but and I'm going to forget his wife's name, but John Ortberg, who Nancy, right. John and Nancy Ortberg were so close to the Hybels as a couple and as leaders at Willow Creek decades ago. And they have been supporting the women who have come out. There's another woman, and I will pull up her name here, who was Nancy Beach, was one of the teaching pastors, I believe, at Willow Creek and has spoken out. There's another board member, I believe, of Willow Creek. So it's splitting, at least the people who were in the larger Willow Creek community. And obviously it's hitting the congregation really hard right now. And because Bill has rejected the accusations, has called them flat out lies, I believe Tuesday night, he softened it a little bit and said some of them, some of the stories were misleading and some were out and out false. You know, he's given folks in the congregation no reason to ask for him to repent or apologize. And so right now I feel for the folks over there, and I feel for the women who have come out because they are the target of attacks from some of Hybels' supporters. And it's just, it's so awful when this happens anywhere, but and maybe we're not supposed to hold the church to a higher standard, but I feel it so much more keenly when it happens inside the church, because, you know, it's a workplace, but it's a family. And this causes so many problems when it comes to employment and churches. But it's just, it is the nature of many, many church communities. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that and kind of how that maybe in some ways blurs some of the lines that pastors can either take advantage of, or that, you know, maybe even unconsciously allows them to cross over lines without really needing to recognize that they exist?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely have some thoughts about that. And to your point about, you know, I don't know if we should hold the church to a higher standard. I actually believe we should. Especially as fellow believers, as Christians, I think it's our duty to hold the church to the highest standard possible for a lot of different reasons. Number one, the reputation of the gospel is a big one, just in the world and what it represents, and how we conduct ourselves is going to be representative of the things that we believe. And so if we really do take our faith seriously, then that means we have to take our actions seriously, which means we have to take the actions of our leaders seriously. And so I think holding the church to the highest standard is actually appropriate. That would be one reason why. The other reason, my thoughts about employment when it comes to church are probably a little bit more complicated, simply because my ecclesiological, is that the word? Ecclesiological views on how church should be structured and whether pastors should get paid and whether there should actually be paid staff and what that does to the messaging and the preaching and the work of the church and this in their communities. I'm of the mind that I actually think that paying pastors and having a kind of business model staff is actually a bad idea. So let's start from that foundation, which is obviously going to complicate the issue a little bit. But
especially when you have an enterprise that we should note is as wide-ranging as Willow Creek. I don't know the exact number of employees, but I mean, they had an HR department. They are a large, a large enterprise.
They're huge. And not just the church, but the ministries that they oversee have their staffs, right? And so, like, I mean, all together, the Willow Creek organization is hundreds and hundreds of people on a payroll. And so, it's a lot of folks. And so that is one of kind of the unique aspects of Willow Creek that kind of sets it apart, is almost like an anomaly, but it's not really, because a lot of churches, big and small, still maintain that more business model where there's, you know, an elder board, which acts as kind of a board of directors. And then there's a lead pastor, which kind of acts as a president or an executive director. Like there's the whole like business model, right? And everyone gets paid. And, you know, there's someone who oversees HR, or, you know, make sure that everyone gets benefits. And so we're paying health benefits and all that kind of stuff to pastors and staff people. And all of that gets very, very complicated the minute that you put a really weird hierarchical structure that includes money into a religious or spiritual situation, when the person at the top oversees the spiritual well-being of the congregation at large. And so when we talk about that, that creates a very strong power dynamic. And when there's that power dynamic is when things can go really poorly, when instances of sexual harassment or abuse come up. And we have seen this time and time again at churches and just in businesses, in organizations, where the person at the top is enigmatic and they make the organization or the church a lot of money, or they bring in a lot of people in the door. That person at the top is the reason why so many people are there, and they don't want to lose that person, right? They don't want to lose that enigmatic figure. And so there's all these weird things that happen where we're protecting the person at the top rather than the people who are victims.
Right. Well, and just to, I don't want to get into all the details here, but we will post in the show notes the blog written by Vonda Dyer, who's the woman who wrote out in great detail. And again, I can't judge the veracity. I will say the details she has, they are very familiar to me and should concern people at the very least in terms of, as you say, kind of the power dynamic in terms of employment, but also a spiritual dynamic. She talks about Bill telling her he thinks she might have the spiritual gift of leadership, which then leads over a number of years to him wanting to have personal meetings about, quote, leadership, as she calls it. And I don't know if that's the term he used with her, but he would like call her to his hotel room where he had a bottle of wine so that they could discuss leadership. And it seems, at least from her description, like that became a cover for spending inappropriate kinds of time with her alone. And that it was only when she became pregnant and had her first child with her husband that he lost interest in her, and she was actually removed from her job at Willow Creek. You know, there are a lot of things that are disturbing about this. I think your point is valid that in the, just even separating out Willow Creek, there can be a lot of difficult dynamics, particularly when there is one person. I mean, a lot of churches, almost all the churches that I have, all of the churches that I have attended and been members at, the church is the people, and the pastor is called by the people and serves at their will. A church that is founded by a particular person is very different in that regard. And that's where things can get really, really sticky.
Yeah. And to your point, You asked me earlier about, you know, what are the, or why we should hold a church to a higher standard, or if we should, your point about the spiritual care of people is another reason why I think we should be holding the church to a higher standard, is because the church is, or should be, let's say this, the church should be the safest place to go. It should be the safest place to go with any problem that you have in your life. It should be the place where you can be the most vulnerable, where you can be the most honest, not just about your spiritual life, but just about your marriage, about parenting, about your work, about whatever the case may be, your health. The church should be the place where you can go first. That should be the place where you are known and loved and cared for the most. And when the church is charged with the spiritual care, the pastoral care, and just the communal care of its people, and there's a horrible abuse of power by the person who oversees that care, all of a sudden, the system is no longer safe. And so why we should hold churches to a higher standard is because the church should be the refuge for these issues. The church should not be a place where these issues take place, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, it would be bad enough if this was one of kind of the standard cases that have come out over the last 6 months of holding out the possibility of a future job promotion, which is what was kind of at play here. But that was also tied up in holding out the possibility that he could discern a divine call to leadership for her. And that is screwed up to twist the two of those together. Again, it's bad enough to kind of coerce somebody to stay in a position that's very uncomfortable for them because you're holding out the possibility of a reward in terms of a new job or a promotion or raise. But to do that under the guise of I can also see something that God has intended for you. I mean, that just smacks of kind of some of the scandals from, you know, 3 decades ago that first got evangelicals in the news.
It just gets super messy, man. When you throw money into any situation, like when you throw employment into a situation, it gets so messy so fast for the church. And all of a sudden you're staring down a lot of problems that the church should not have to deal with. Not just have to deal with, but like I said, the church should be a refuge. And by creating, you know, business models of employment and all that stuff, you're creating even more problematic avenues of, you know, these sorts of behaviors. So it's a bummer.
I would be interested to go down that road in a longer conversation sometime. Before we move on to the next topic, I do just want to say there's a lot of collateral damage here. And in addition to the women who have been silent for so long and now been brave enough to speak up, I so feel for Lynn Hybels. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe she's an ordained minister. Is that right? But she is in everything but official position, kind of the co-leader of Willow Creek. She has been so integral to maintaining that community. And as you say, she's been such a spiritual mentor for so many younger evangelical women. I hope she's finding support right now.
Yeah, she is just a remarkable human. The peacemaking work that she does around the world, the organizations that she is deeply involved with and helps lead, she's one of those women that you look at, and I have said this to so many people. I say, like, man, I hope I can be like Lynn Hybels when I grow up. Like, she's one of those women that is out there not just talking the talk but walking the walk in every single way that she lives her life. And she is a complete model of humble leadership and true peacemaking and someone who pours herself into the life of other people so selflessly. And yeah, it just it just breaks my heart. And of course, for Shauna to have this happen to your dad, who is your hero and, you know, you love so much, and to see it all just get, I mean, I just can't imagine as a daughter what that feels like. It's just, it sucks. It sucks. That's why I say, like, it literally sucks for every single person that's involved. There's a lot of collateral damage. Obviously the people who feel like they were harassed or abused is number one. But it's important to know that there are a lot of other women that have to deal with the consequences of what happens when something like this goes down. It makes me think of Savannah Guthrie when the news hit with Matt Lauer, and she was so honest on air. They were so honest, and they just said, like, you know, she was in tears of going, like, what do you do when you learn something like this about someone that you love? You know, it's just so hard. And so I can't imagine how difficult it must be. So anyway, let's move on. Switching subjects for our next discussion, although equally enraging and sad, we absolutely had to take up a new BuzzFeed News analysis of Muslim bashing by American politicians over the past 3 years, almost exclusively by Republican politicians. Some attacks were more subtle and coded, and others were literally dripping with hate.
Not literally dripping with hate. Just a grammar Nazi you there for a minute.
Well, okay, I'm going to sidetrack, but you need to watch Parks and Rec. They all sought to dehumanize and demonize Muslims. BuzzFeed found this anti-Muslim activity and rhetoric wasn't limited to a particular geographic area. Journalists found examples of Muslim bashing in 49 states. And they found that very few politicians have faced any repercussions for going after Muslims. If anything, they have been encouraged by the Muslim bashing modeled in the White House. Amy.
So I feel like we need to read some of the examples from the lead in this story, because it's just, it's overwhelming. I think people have a general sense that Muslim Americans have felt very unsafe, and that, of course, this administration, from the very first days of Trump taking office, has focused on Muslims and keeping Muslims out of the country. And, you know, just to take one example with Syria in the news this week, it is hard to listen to people fulminating about what's going on in Syria, which is horrific, at the same time that they are the exact same people who have kept those refugees out of our country and who have turned their backs on them. So here are some of the examples just from the lead of this piece. A state lawmaker in Oklahoma refused to meet with Muslim constituents unless they replied to a questionnaire asking if they beat their wives. That was one example. A Nebraska state senator suggested that any Muslim wanting to enter the United States be forced to eat pork first. That's classy. And a Rhode Island legislator advocated herding Syrian refugees into a camp, writing in an email that Muslims seek to, quote, murder, rape, and decapitate anyone who is a non-Muslim. So some of this is just flat-out ignorance. People need to educate themselves. Some of it is, I suppose, what happens when you isolate yourself in a media ghetto that gives you only extremely off information about entire groups and demographics. But some of it is just the kind of hateful nativism and religious bigotry that unfortunately crops up over history from time to time. And this is a really sorry moment of history. We talked a few months ago about a kind of new movement for Christian-Muslim understanding. And it's been good to see a few Republican politicians get involved in that, a few evangelical leaders embrace that and say that if we're going to be for religious liberty and for protecting people of faith, then we have to embrace that across the board. And that includes Muslims as well. I hope that they all read this analysis really, really carefully. because this is not isolated. As you said, they found examples in 49 states. So it's not like, oh, this is a problem in the South, or this is a problem just in pockets where you have, you know, large numbers of Muslim immigrants. No, this is across the country, and that is not a coincidence. We have talked before on the podcast, but I'm going to repeat it again because it's really, really important, about the effect of the presidential bully pulpit and the fact that after 9/11, when we would have had, you would have expected to hear a lot of Muslim bashing, and there was some anti-Muslim violence, some of it directed at anybody who was suspected of being Muslim. So there were some really outrageous, horrible incidents in which Sikhs were the victims, because people do not know their religious minorities in the U.S. But George W. Bush really deserves a lot of credit for stepping up in that really emotional moment and insisting that Islam is a religion of peace. He went to an Islamic center in Washington, D.C., not even 4 days after the attacks happened, and met with leaders there, prayed with them there, and went on TV telling Americans that this was not Islam. This was some isolated individuals who have a perverted version of their faith, but that Islam itself is a religion of peace. And we know that that had an effect. I was working at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life at the time, and we put a poll in the field less than 2 months later. It was in early November of 2001. And we asked people their views about all sorts of groups. These are questions that Pew has, asked continuously for years and years and years. So we knew from just March of that year what people thought about Muslims. And attitudes about Muslims had actually improved. And the group that had the largest improvement were the most conservative Republicans. Now, granted, they also had the largest gap to improve. But it did tell you that they were listening to their president and they were following his lead. Now, unfortunately, that didn't hold. And part of that, a big part of it, is that we then went after Iraq and went into war in Iraq. And a lot of the actions of the administration undercut that initial rhetoric from Bush. But he, as a leader, continued to embrace Muslim leaders and to be supportive. And as I say, at a crucial time in our history, that made a difference. We are seeing the exact opposite of that right now. The person who should be setting a calm and not just tolerant, but welcoming and embracing tone is the one being the most hateful. And therefore, not just indicating that that's allowed, but proving to everybody that it goes unpunished, that you can give in to your worst impulses and it will not hurt you. Nobody is going to sanction you. Nobody's going to kick you out of office or call for your resignation. No.
The other thing that I do want to talk about that probably is a little bit, maybe not as popular of a view, on top of President Trump and the presidential pulpit and the power that it has, on top of outlets like Fox News and Breitbart and all these, you know, horrible, crazy, like misinformed, false lies, perpetuation of, you know, like these caricatures of Muslims. Something that I think we do need to talk about is just the general coverage of Muslims in the media. And we don't see as many stories that normalize the Muslim community as much as we hear about Muslims being terrorists. And that's a coverage problem. And so the media that we are consuming, the things that we're giving coverage, are overwhelmingly negative toward Muslims. And I think that is perpetuating a lot of the caricatures and a lot of the wrong and skewed perceptions about the Muslim community. When the only thing that you're hearing about Muslims from, you know, the bigger networks is terrorist attacks and what's happening in the Middle East, that is going to be your primary picture. Especially if you live in places where there isn't a Muslim community, where there isn't, where your interactions with a Muslim person is going to be limited. I mean, I think most recently about just my move to this tiny town in central Idaho. Like the chances of me running into a Muslim here compared to the last city that I was living in a big metropolitan area is obviously very, very limited.
And see, I would disagree, actually. I think that it could always be better. But if we look at the context of the last 20 years, certainly in pop culture, it has become more nuanced. You know, the days of 24 and having, you know, Muslim terrorists be the big baddies in every blockbuster movie and, you know, action television show, those were incredibly damaging. And we are just starting to get out of that and to have, you know, a few portrayals. Just to take one, Master of None with Aziz Ansari has him as an Indian Muslim, an Indian American who is Muslim, as the main character. And, you know, several episodes that deal with just the everyday ordinary things about being a Muslim who's not terribly religious, who considers himself mostly secular, but whose family, you know, still has a lot of ties to it. The Big Sick was a movie that came out last year, also featuring a Muslim American character. We've got some Muslim American comics who are have been on The Daily Show and who have actually, you know, in some cases hit it kind of big, opened for Dave Chappelle and some of his tours. It's certainly not ideal. But I do think taking the broad look over the last few decades that it's getting better. And if anything, I would argue there's just not a lot of coverage. I mean, one thing is that Trump is, he's just pushing out all other news. But, you know, like 10 years ago, we heard a lot more about incidents where people were protesting the building of a mosque, or I'm trying to remember what exactly it was. It was an Islamic cultural center near Ground Zero, about 10 years ago, I think, that Republicans were all up in arms about, led by Newt Gingrich, among other people. And we don't hear that so much. At the local level, I do know of a lot of cases where Muslims have been very smart in how they have gone about getting involved with communities and really fostering relationships with local reporters, so that if they're doing some outreach and like coordinating a food pantry with, say, a Christian group, there will be a positive story in the local paper. There are not enough of these, and Trump has pushed us back so many steps from where we were in the last year of Obama's administration. He appeared at a mosque in Maryland and gave a really stunning talk about Muslim Americans and how they are now part of the fabric of American life. And that was a sign of where we could be and where I think we can get back to. But unfortunately, it doesn't make much of a difference when the guy at the top insists on just repeating things, whether they're true or not. He's just going to keep saying Mexicans are rapists, and he's just going to keep saying that Muslims decapitate people. And he does not care that he is slandering, you know, hundreds of millions of people when he does that.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, my point is that, I mean, have we made strides? Yes. Is it still overwhelmingly skewed negative? Yes. And so I think that, like, yes, like I said, like, we can't discredit Trump. We can't discredit all these other kind of, like, aspects of why anti-Muslim sentiment is now back on the rise. Like, those are true, but the things that we're choosing to give airtime to, I think, does play a part. I mean, we just have to talk about it. Like, we have to talk about, like, how much airtime we give to a Trump tweet, which I understand he is the president of the United States. And so, like, there is a level of coverage that has to go there. But those of us who are consuming the news have control over what we're consuming as well. And so I just think that there's still so much more we could be doing as far as positive coverage of the Muslim community that could push us even further. And as we have both advocated for at length on this podcast, the more religion reporters that we have in major newsrooms that are very well educated in religion, the better. And I would love to see people who are in newsrooms, more people who are in newsrooms covering religion, who have a deep, deep understanding, or even maybe are themselves practicing Muslims, start covering more about what's happening in the Muslim community from a more positive perspective, so that it's not simply, you know, like, oh, here we go again with so-and-so saying Muslims should eat pork or something. You know what I mean? Like, I think that we have to approach the media thing from both a consumer standpoint and also from a coverage standpoint.
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, as a journalist, I am always up for critiquing how religion is covered. But I stand by this. I really do think that the coverage has improved. That, you know, you can't help it. You have to cover what's going on in Syria. And you've got Muslims on all sides in that that situation. You know, if people may draw inferences from that, but I think it's been pretty responsible the way that news outlets have covered it. I think, maybe in future episodes we'll need to highlight some of the positive coverage. But just to take one outlet, NPR does have several Muslim American staff people who have done a really excellent job and who go out of their way to report different kinds of stories. You know, this is an issue that we don't have time to go all the way into today, but that is as old as, you know, the field of media criticism, which is, at the end of the day, most journalists don't see it as their job to cover positive stories. And I go back and forth on this because, you know, you're supposed to cover the news. And this is something I end up talking with a lot of religious progressives about, is you wanting peace and justice is not news. Do something like the Lynchburg revival with Red Letter Christians. That's news. But, you know, it's got to be a real something that journalists can go cover. There just are, there aren't so many examples of that, nor do I think that a lot of groups should be putting their time and their resources into just, you know, producing events in order to give journalists something to write about. So that is down the line. We can definitely do an episode on media criticism of religion. But let's move on to our final topic. And we'll do this quickly because I will point you all to my piece. You can take a read for yourselves. But a few months ago, I was contacted by my editors at the New York Times to write an analytical piece that would run on Easter Sunday. And like many of you, I am sick and tired of discussing why white evangelicals continue to stand by Trump. I feel like that ground has been well covered. But that was my assignment. And I recognize that even after all we have seen over the past few years, the phrase evangelical is still supposed to conjure up somebody who's concerned above all else with purity and piety. And if that is the case, it kind of naturally confuses a lot of people that white evangelicals would be such steadfast supporters of a guy who, it now seems pretty clear, cheated on his wife with at least one porn star and then arranged for her to be paid hush money. On the face of that, that seems to not compute. If you are a regular listener to the podcast, you understand already. But for this piece, I did not have the heart to go back through all the explanations we've discussed on this show. The persecution complexes of conservative Christians, how much white evangelicals hate Hillary Clinton, the nonsense comparing Trump to King Cyrus or King David. You know, all of these factors play a role, but at the end of the day, it's really very simple. And I felt like it's the elephant in the room, pun intended, that people just don't want to address, which is it all comes down to partisanship. And here's the key part of my piece, which I'm going to read. Nearly 40 years after the Moral Majority's founding, the partisan meld is complete. Decades of fear-mongering about Democrats and religious liberals have worked. 80% of white evangelicals would vote against Jesus Christ himself if he ran as a Democrat. And to me, that's what it comes down to. I wish it wasn't so cut and dried, but Nish, I just have to tell you, like, during the campaign, and particularly after Trump got the nomination, and there was a big gathering in June of 2016 where there were hundreds of evangelicals at a hotel in New York, and he went and spoke with them. I listened to the audio that we got smuggled out from that meeting, and I thought, this is laughable. Like, it's so color by numbers pandering that surely evangelicals will find this insulting, because it's there was no art to it. He was just standing up and blatantly saying, I love the evangelicals. I will protect you. People hate you. I will protect you. And evangelicals are going to be better than they've ever seen. You're going to love me more than even Jesus Christ. Okay, maybe not. But I'll be as much a hero to you as Jesus Christ. And like, if any Democrat tried to say something like that, they would be rightly called out for just the offensive vote mongering there. And it's just so blatant that I thought, you know, that will work with some people, but come on. It's just insulting to be so easy to get that way. But I was wrong.
Yeah. It's, I have said this in a few places, and I'll repeat it here for anyone who hasn't heard me say it, because I've said it in some talks and some other interviews, but I am 35, and I do not know an America where white evangelicalism was not intimately married with the Republican Party. That is the only thing I have ever known. That marriage has been the reality of my understanding of evangelical religious life in America. And what you said about the partisan meld is complete, I absolutely 100% completely agree with you, because what has happened to make that partisan meld complete is that for so many white evangelicals who continue to support Donald Trump, even in the face of Stormy Daniels and in the face of, I mean, literal, I could go down the list and it would be a mile long. We don't have time. But for so many people who continue to support him, I firmly, firmly believe that they are in a position now where their politics are informing their faith rather than their faith informing their politics. And there was a shift that happened somewhere in the last 30 years, and it was solidified in November of 2016. And the minute that your politics inform your faith instead of your faith informing your politics is the minute that your faith doesn't really mean so much anymore and you become a hypocrite. Which is why I think a lot of us feel so angry about this partisan meld, is because for so long, even though they were married to the Republican Party in so many ways over issues of abortion and gay marriage and a bunch of other things, right? It was, even for all of Jerry Falwell Sr.'s faults and issues, his deeply held beliefs and sincerity, I think, is truly what drove a lot of his kind of partisan politics. His faith drove his politics. And that is not the case anymore. And we see that so clearly with Donald Trump. because we can look back at a very similar situation in the 90s with Bill Clinton and look at all of these same religious leaders who spoke so forcefully and so loudly about immorality and family values and blah, 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 right? And none of that matters anymore because it aligns with their political party. And that is when your politics is informing your faith rather than your faith informing your politics. And I hate talking about white evangelicals so much, but because I kind of am one a little bit, it almost hurts more, you know what I mean? Because you know, like, you know what it used to be. And I'm not saying that what it used to be was perfect. Like, there were a lot of flaws with how white evangelicalism conducted itself in politics, even back then in the 80s and 90s. I'm not saying that it was great, but you look at it then and then you look at it now and there is a shift. And I think everyone who is looking...
Don't even have to go back that far.
No, not even that far.
One of the things that I was really struck by, and I had to include in the piece, was... I thought, okay, well, there's the hypocrisy around Clinton and Trump, and, you know, I kind of expect that from them. But, you know, what accounts for the continued high support? Not just, you know, voting for him 80, 81%, but sticking with him now, because his support number is still really, really high. I think his, in the latest Gallup poll, he had... approval ratings somewhere around like 79% from white evangelicals. And so you could say, okay, well, he delivered them a Supreme Court seat. Okay, well, let's go look at George W. Bush just 12 years ago, after he had gotten an almost as high percentage of the white evangelical vote in his reelection in 2004. He got 78% of the white evangelical vote. Then right after, in 2005, there were two openings on the Supreme Court, you may remember, and back to back, he appointed John Roberts, Chief Justice, and Samuel Alito. Those are two pretty big gets for the religious right. They weren't evangelicals, they were Catholics, whatever. They were going to vote the way they wanted them to on issues and have. So you would think if it's all about getting the Supreme Court seat, well, then evangelical support for Bush should have held, right? By May 2006, so just a few months after Alito was confirmed and put on the seat, white evangelical support for Bush had slid down to 55%. So dropped more than 20 points in not even a year and a half from the election. So the same point in his second term that Trump is at in his first term. It makes me, I guess, a little more hopeful, knowing that so recently white evangelicals were capable of expressing disapproval to a Republican president, even one who had delivered two Supreme Court seats for them. But it also just makes me wonder, it does make me wonder who these white evangelicals are. And this we may have to get into with some pollsters in the future, because it's very possible that the folks who are continuing to call themselves evangelical are a smaller and more, I don't want to say pure, but purist group than the ones who would have been captured in that 2006 poll and the ones who would have been captured 10 years before that. I just don't know if when we speak of white evangelicals now and we look at polling numbers, we're really comparing apples to apples, or if we've got two different groups going on. So that's something for us to keep our eye on.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I would like to not talk about white evangelicals.
Can do.
But I know we're going to have to, because they just keep
we'll try
being
to
branch
out
the
a little
worst.
Bit next week, so that is it for our topics this week. But to wrap up the show, every week we like to leave listeners with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music or a podcast. Nish, do you have anything for us? I know you are still mostly without internet up in the woods of Idaho.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I think the way I described you relocating made some people believe you were in the witness protection program. Nish is busy relocating with her family to central Idaho.
Yeah, because, I mean, let's be honest, what do most people know about Idaho? That there's, like, crazy squatters that live out here that are hiding from the federal government. Okay, what do I have this week? Yeah, we don't have a lot of internet, so I haven't really watched, I don't know, anything. So as soon as the snow melts, we'll get fast internet, and I'll be able to go back to watching all of my television shows and movies that I love so much.
But I love that it's dependent on the snow melting.
There's so much snow, and it's still freaking snowing. It's snowing outside right now, and there's another, like, 3 to 4 inches on the ground. We're going to thaw eventually. Life choices. But you know what? It's fine. It's beautiful. It's like Narnia out there. But the upside to not having internet is that I'm, like, back to reading a lot of books. Like, I'm a naturally voracious reader anyway, but now that I don't have TV to watch, I'm reading even more, which is super fun for me. So I just ordered a new book that everyone is raving about, and I am just getting ready to crack it open. And so I'm going to go ahead and put it on everyone else's radar so that maybe we can have a little implied company book club. it is called The Female Persuasion. The Female Persuasion. I cannot remember the name of the author, but it's got a really brightly colored cover. Anyway, it's a novel, and it's about, Meg Wolitzer. There you go. Wonderful, wonderful writer. Let's do a book club. And so it's a novel. So it's a fictional story, but it's about ambition and being a female and kind of a lot of feminist themes that run through it that are apparently very, very timely and kind of coincide with a lot of what's happening in our culture right now. So super excited to read it. So if you want to read alongside me, please pick up a copy at your local library or at your local bookstore first. And then if they don't have it, go to Amazon. That's what I like to tell people. So that is my recommendation. If anyone wants to read with me, that's what I'm going for. What about you? What do you got?
Well, I have an update and a recommendation. In the episode that was co-hosted by Jack Jenkins, I believe it was right before Easter, I said I was looking forward to watching Jesus Christ Superstar for the first time.
Oh, it was and, so good.
Yes, I realized it was over the top and flashy and loud and all of that, but that's the kind of musical I love. So I was enjoying it. And regular listeners will not be shocked to hear that little Cormac is now Jesus Christ Superstar. Both of the kids really like it.
You have a Broadway star on your hands. Well, that's what I think.
I told them, and I have not let them watch the whole thing, but they really wanted to hear the main song. So I showed them that part, and then it goes straight into the crucifixion. And I was like, guys, this gets kind of dark. And he was just rapt, just sat on my lap like, no, mama, we cannot turn this off. And we got into some really interesting theological discussions.
I bet.
Because he wanted to know, why is Jesus saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? So, I don't know if he's going to be a Broadway star or a divinity school professor or both.
Or both.
But I was picking him up from preschool the other day and I heard him singing. And I turned around and said, what was that? And he looked a little shy and was like, Jesus Christ Superstar.
The best.
So I am loving this. We've been listening to it every day this week on the way to school.
And John Legend nailed it. Yes, nailed it. Yeah. So good.
My Jesus.
So good.
But the recommendation I have is for another podcast, which is new to me, but on its second season now. It's called Depolarize. And it's hosted by a guy named Dan Koch. I do not know his story. I need to figure it out. But he does some of our terrain, talks about religion and politics. But he has devoted the whole second season, which he has already reported out quite a bit, to unpacking this 81% of white evangelicals number. And it's really fascinating. He talks to white evangelicals who voted for Trump. He talks to people who didn't. He's trying to get at how much of this is what we were just talking about, a cultural identifier instead of kind of a reflection of their faith and values. And I will just caution, he has a co-host for the second season who drives me up a wall. And I do think that in their zeal to do a like even-handed both sides, they really end up like misbalancing things of like, yes, well, you know, conservatives yell about fake news, but then, you know, everybody's kind of reading the news from their own, you know, their own spot, their own ideological position. Yeah, it's not really the same on both sides there. Given that caution, I binged three episodes on a long drive last week and am about to set off on another 4-hour drive and listen to more. So I highly recommend that. It's called Depolarize.
Okay, have to listen. Alrighty, well, that's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you would like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.